You are listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today we welcome Dr. Kevin Ewan, a prominent neuroendocrinologist and leading expert on adult growth hormone deficiency. Dr. Blevins caught up with Dr. Ewan at the recent American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists conference held in Los Angeles. Here are Dr. Ewan and Dr. Blevins.
Good morning, this is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. I'm in Los Angeles, California at the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists National Meeting, which is actually becoming quite international these days. And I have with me today Dr. Kevin Ewan, who's the Medical Director of the Pituitary Center at Barrow Neurosurgical Institute, or Neurological Institute, I should say, in Phoenix, Arizona. And he's a professor of medicine there. Kevin, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So I wonder if you would start by telling us about your background and training.
Sure. So I was trained in the United Kingdom and did my undergraduate training there, medical school, residency and fellowship in endocrinology at the University of Cambridge. And I also took an extra 3 to 5 years extra to write up my thesis, primarily looking at the effects of different doses of growth hormone replacement in patients with growth hormone deficiency, both in transition and adults, and then decided to come over to the U.S. for my postdoc experience and ended up staying here 13 years ago, and now I'm still here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, we're very glad you're here, and I know the people in the Southwest are glad you're here as well. So you have been really instrumental in pushing forward with studies of a new molecule used in diagnostic testing of growth hormone deficiency. And I want to talk about that for a bit before we move on to other topics. So one of the first questions I'll ask is, tell us why. Why a new test for growth hormone deficiency?
Sure, absolutely. So as you know, growth hormone deficiency, at least in terms of diagnosing growth hormone deficiency, has always been in the realms of pediatrics, where, you know, children who are not able to grow, short stature, is pretty easy, it's pretty obvious that it prompts the testing of growth of growth hormone deficiency in children. But in adults, it's not so easy. Growth hormone production in your pituitary is very variable, and it's also time dependent. It's highest in the mornings and it tends to be lowest in the evenings, and it goes up and down during the day, and in patients with growth, certainly in adults with growth hormone deficiency, the symptoms are not as pronounced as, say, in a child with growth hormone deficiency, because the child with growth hormone deficiency, they present with inability or problems with growing, whereas for adults, symptoms are primarily central weight gain, physical fatigue, mental fatigue, and difficulty in concentrating, cognitive impairment. So all these things are rather non-specific. So in order to accurately and correctly diagnose growth hormone deficiency, one requires certain steps. One requires to adhere to certain steps. Number one, to think whether the patient has growth hormone deficiency based on the history. For example, whether the patient had head injury from a motor vehicle accident, or previous pituitary surgery for a pituitary tumor, or radiation to the brain. So these things can actually increase the risk of developing adult growth hormone deficiency. And then coupled with the symptoms that a patient is presenting to you, that will then initiate or prompt you to then test the patient further. And there are no good reliable blood tests, therefore growth hormone stimulation tests is really the only way to confirm the diagnosis of growth hormone deficiency, with the exception of patients who have had 3 pituitary hormone deficiency and low IGF-1. Those patients have a 95% chance of developing or of having growth hormone deficiency. Otherwise, all other patients require growth hormone stimulation tests. The other issue with growth hormone stimulation tests is that it's not the easiest procedure to perform, certainly in an office setting, simply because it requires the patient to come in fasted, it requires an IV line, it requires multiple blood draws, it requires medication to be administered to the patient, and sometimes patients can develop side effects from the test as well, so it requires medical supervision. So all these factors make it sometimes quite challenging to safely perform these tests. Hence, at the moment we have two tests that we use in the US. One is called the insulin tolerance test, which is a test that basically induces very low blood sugars in you, in a patient, in order to then measure growth hormone, which is not the most pleasant test to endure. And then the other test is the glucagon test, which is typically a 3 to 4 hour test, whereby about 20 to 30% of patients can develop nausea, vomiting, which again, not very pleasant, and also the fact that the test is quite long in terms of duration. So there has been an unmet need in this area, and recently there is a new molecule that has been studied. It's called mesomelrelin, which is a ghrelin mimetic, and essentially what it does is that you drink the medication. It's in a form of a drink, and it works onto your brain directly very quickly to stimulate your brain, specifically your pituitary, in producing growth hormone. So it's a very easy test to do. Patients come in fasted, and an IV line is put in, and then you measure your weight, and then the dose of the drug is based on your weight, and you drink the drug literally over 30 seconds, and then blood is then drawn at 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 60, and 90 minutes. So essentially four blood draws, and that's it. The test is done. And pretty much in the studies, we have found that there are very minimal side effects. Perhaps the most common report that the patients complain of is a little bit of bitterness in their tongue, but that's essentially the only side effect that has been reported. But otherwise, none else really, and the results are very good. It's almost comparable to the insulin tolerance test, if not better.
So it meets all the criteria. Is an excellent diagnostic test. It clearly is something that's oral instead of IV, and the patients have the IV for the growth hormone draws. And it's not cumbersome as are the other tests. It doesn't require physician and attendance. It really, I think, is an ideal way to test for growth hormone deficiency. Can you tell us what sort of responses you see in normal people? What do the growth hormone levels do? How high do they go?
Oh yeah.
And then
yeah.
What are the criteria that you use to determine whether a patient has growth hormone deficiency, sure, and requires treatment?
So in a normal subject, obviously the younger the patient is, the more exuberant the growth hormone response has been. We've seen growth hormone levels as high as 10, sometimes even 15 nanograms per liter. Or peak growth hormone levels, that is, that we're talking about, sometimes up to 20. So these are high levels that the drug is able to induce versus a patient with growth hormone with adult growth hormone deficiency, where levels typically tend to be flat, or at least below 2.8 or even below 5. So these levels are considered low, and that's how the diagnostic criteria has been put forth, whereby if the peak growth hormone does not exceed 2.8, at least mandated by the FDA. I forgot to mention this drug is also approved by the FDA. Mandated by the FDA with a growth hormone cut point of 2.8, then the patient is considered to have growth hormone deficiency. I also want to add that in our studies, the growth hormone cut point can be as high as 5.1, and even as high as 5.1 versus 2.8, the sensitivity of the test remains maintained, and the specificity of the test is also maintained. So in other words, there are certain patients where if you're highly suspicious of underlying growth hormone deficiency in them, and if they stim up to say 4 or 5, they can possibly still be growth hormone deficient as well, although the proposed cut point is 2.8.
That sounds like a very good plan of medical decision making. If you had someone who came to you and had a low normal IGF-1 and no history of pituitary disease and wanted to be tested for growth hormone deficiency, it would make sense to use that cutoff at 2.8. Whereas if you had someone who had a history of a pituitary adenoma and had surgery and was maybe missing gonadal functions and maybe thyroid functions at all, maybe with intact adrenal function, their pretest probability of being abnormal is high, so that maybe a cutoff of 5.1 would be a better choice for that type of patient.
That's absolutely right. Certainly, you have to deal with each individual patient accordingly and the history that the patient is presenting in front of you. The other thing to note as well that was interesting during our studies of this compound is the fact that when we compared the peak growth hormone levels induced by mesomelarin versus the peak growth hormone levels induced during an insulin tolerance test, there is a suggestion that the peak growth hormone levels induced by mesomelarin was in fact somewhat slightly higher than the insulin tolerance test, suggesting that perhaps the mesomelarin is perhaps a more potent growth hormone releaser compared to insulin. Which is interesting, because if you have a patient that you have a low pretest probability of having underlying adult growth hormone deficiency, then with a potent growth hormone secretagogue, you will end up testing negative in these patients, which is really what you want.
Fascinating. So tell me about pediatrics. Has this been studied in children, or are they still using more traditional, old-fashioned methods in kids these days?
Good question. So certainly before, historically, even before these studies were done, there are absolutely no studies that actually have been done in both adults and children, until recently where we studied the insulin tolerance test and the GHRH arginine in adults comparing to mesomelarin. But certainly in the pediatric population, there has not been any well-designed studies looking at this question. So short answer is no, there hasn't been any good studies looking at the growth hormone stimulation test in the pediatric population. The study that was done on mesomelarin is conducted where we enrolled patients 18 years and above up to the age of 69. So in theory, you can say that anyone below 18 has not been studied. Now, I believe that Novo Nordisk, which is a company now that is overseeing this medication, are planning to embark in a study in looking at a pediatric cohort, but that study requires a very careful thought into the study design, because really in pediatrics you have to study both many different types of patients with potential growth hormone deficiency. You're probably having to study the idiopathic patients, you're probably going to have to study the TBI patients, you're probably going to have to study the childhood onset cancer patients with radiation. So these are different types of patients which we don't know how they will react or they will respond to mesomelarin. So careful thought needs to be put in terms of designing these studies in the pediatric population.
Okay, very interesting.
A quick reminder that you are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. If you'd like to make a donation to help us continue to bring you content like this, please visit our website at pituitaryworldnews.org and click on Get Involved. Your donations are totally tax deductible. Thank you. We now continue with Dr. Blevins and Dr. Ewan.
So moving on to another topic, I understand that you're presenting today as the lead physician on a task force of developing guidelines for the treatment of adult growth hormone deficiency. And I wonder if you could share with us just a general summary of some of the changes compared to the last set of guidelines.
Yeah.
And certainly things that might be of interest to the patients out there who are listening today.
So absolutely. So I think the first question is, why another set of guidelines? Because at least the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, they put out, or certainly me being on the lead author, put out the guidelines back in 2009. So this is like a 10th year anniversary. But certainly in the last 10 years, there's a lot of developments that have happened that has helped clinicians in terms of better understanding how to better treat patients with this condition, certainly in both transition and adults with growth hormone deficiency. We do know that there are more studies now demonstrating the benefits of growth hormone growth hormone replacement in adults, such as improvement in cardiovascular risk markers, which potentially may translate into future cardiovascular risk, like heart attacks and strokes. We also have studied and found that the dosing needs to be addressed. Certainly, we need to be giving lower doses in older patients who are typically more growth hormone sensitive versus higher doses in younger patients. We need to be more cautious in our dosing, especially in patients with a propensity to developing diabetes, because higher doses can actually aggravate blood sugars and promote glucose intolerance. We also have patients now who have traumatic brain injury now who are being increasingly tested for hypopituitarism, and growth hormone deficiency is one of the more common pituitary hormone deficiencies that can manifest after traumatic brain injury. So that's another new development. There's also other causes of growth hormone deficiency that are now being described, like CNS infections, like meningitis, meningoencephalitis, subarachnoid hemorrhages that can potentially cause growth hormone deficiency. So those types of patients need to be thought of, at least in terms of thinking whether or not they need to be tested. So new groups are being described now that potentially may be predisposed to growth hormone deficiency. And then obviously with the new data that we are now presenting on massimorelin, that hopefully will improve the efficiency and the accuracy of the tests, of the testing part of growth hormone deficiency, which many providers can potentially hopefully use this test to test the appropriate patient with a high pretest probability. And also there's also this issue of the inappropriate and misuse of growth hormone in non-medical conditions such as aging and sports, which is illegal and certainly not encouraged for use, and the dangers of long-term use in these types of conditions, which is highly discouraged. So that needs to be emphasized given the increasing use in this day and age. And then finally, there's also a lot of studies in the last 5 to 6 years of long-acting growth hormone preparations. In other words, growth hormone preparations that can be administered once a week, which obviously the major advantage is that they will reduce the number of injections that patients are giving themselves. And that is obviously a benefit, especially patients who are complaining of having too many injections, particularly as if they have diabetes and they're taking insulin, they're taking testosterone, and then they're taking growth hormone. So a patient could potentially end up taking 3 or 4 injections a day, which could be challenging and therefore could also impact the adherence long term, which then subsequently affect the long term efficacy. So the hope is that long term growth hormone preparations are coming out, they're being studied. Currently they're being looked at carefully, specifically for their safety profile, given that it's a long term, it's a long acting drug. And so if it's approved, then it's going to be very interesting and very helpful for clinicians and patients alike in terms of considering using long-acting growth hormone for their daily management of their condition.
So with the long-acting form of a growth hormone preparation on the horizon, how long do you think it'll be before this is available for our patients?
Yeah, good question. I think certainly in the recent Endocrine Society meeting, there are a couple of really interesting studies that have been published on the long-acting growth hormone. And certainly, number one, it's meeting its objectives, its primary endpoints in terms of improving body composition. And certainly, there are no safety signals, at least up till now, which is obviously another major issue that we need to take into consideration. So I think it bodes well. But certainly, I think the long-acting growth hormone preparations still need to be closely followed up, just to make sure that we don't we don't increase the side effects of patients. But I'm thinking in the next 2 or 3 years, hopefully there could be, you know, new things in the horizon, and hopefully new compounds that could be approved by the FDA.
Yeah, it's something I know that many of the patients out there listening are looking forward to. I, as a physician, am as well. It's going to be very curious, though, given the things that happen in pharmaceutical industry this day and age, how this comes about as a pricing issue.
Yeah,
because they could price themselves out of business, and insurance companies could require patients to use their traditional daily injections if they're not careful about those types of things.
Sure, and it's a complex issue, the pricing issue. And certainly, I guess if you have a long-acting growth hormone, then you potentially could save in terms of injections. So the cost of daily injections could be reduced markedly from 52 injections a year to 365 injections a year. So the injections itself could be a cost-saving part of it. But certainly the drug itself, I think companies need to price it competitively and appropriately, or maybe even comparatively to similarly to the daily growth hormone injections.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if you look at the cost of the devices, the drug, add that together as your overall cost of treatment, they should really come in about the same. Mm-hmm. And then they'll just take over the market.
Yeah,
Which would be the way I would do it. Maybe they can't do that in the long run, but sort of that cornering the market isn't always allowed by the regulatory agencies. But it'll be very interesting to see that hit the market and to see what's going to happen. I agree with you. The patients are going to have to be followed very closely to ensure they don't develop acromegalic symptoms and signs, or what we call the symptoms of overtreatment. But that's something we'll know over time. Patients have to be treated for a long period of time.
Especially, I think patients might even ask the question, this is a long-acting compound, so if I do develop the side effects, will my side effects be prolonged? I mean, that's another question that we just don't know.
That's a very good point.
And if the side effects are prolonged, how do we deal with it? Because conventionally, the daily growth hormone injections, the conventional wisdom is that because it's daily, it means that the duration of the action of growth hormone is much shorter, so you would expect side effects to last much shorter. So that's another issue. And then the other issue with long-acting growth hormone is that when do we actually measure IGF-1? We have testosterone that we give every 2 weeks that we measure in the middle of the injection. So is this something that we will do for IGF-1s in between the injections? Is this the most appropriate time to measure IGF-1? Or whether in measuring IGF-1, the timing of measuring IGF-1, is it different between different long-acting compounds? Is again an open question that I think needs to be ironed out before these compounds should be made available. So I think there's still several unanswered questions, and I'm thinking in the next 2 or 3 years, hopefully we'll get more answers as well.
Yeah, well, I look forward to learning more, as you do as well. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a great discussion, and good luck to you for your presentation, and I'll see you next week at another meeting.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, folks, for listening. Once again, Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Have a wonderful day. Bye.